This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. About 50% of all marriages in America now end in divorce. It didn't used to be that way, and it doesn't speak well for the institution of marriage or possibly our approach to it. Perhaps it's because we live in an instant gratification society that we move on if we aren't instantly gratified. Perhaps it's because we live in a disposable society that has led us to regard wedding vows as disposable, or perhaps our approach is merely a part of the evolution of marriage itself. Lisa Grunwald and her journalist husband compiled centuries worth of advice on marriage, and the result is The Marriage Book, which also chronicles how our views on marriage have changed and how the definition of a successful marriage has evolved over time. Since June is the height of wedding season, we thought we'd invite Lisa Grunwald to share some of what she learned about marriage through centuries of advice, inspiration, and cautionary tales from Adam and Eve to Zoloft. Lisa Grunwald, welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thanks so much.
Why did you and your husband, Stephen Adler, decide to write this book in the first place?
Well, some people might say masochism on our part, but not really. We had done two anthologies before this, one of letters of the 20th century and one of women's letters. And when we were in the middle of doing the women's letters book, we kept finding things about marriage, and it was just so intriguing. We decided to go in for a third book together and, you know, enjoyed it enormously.
They say married couples should avoid working together. You've worked together now
yes,
on three books.
Costs.
So did working together on that first project concern either of you? And what has been the impact of your working together over these three books?
Well, the fact is we're both journalists, we're both writers and editors, and yet we always worked in separate places. So the ability to have what we've always referred to as the mom and pop shop of our books has been a delight. I don't necessarily recommend this for anyone or everyone, but if you happen to have a shared interest and compatible talents, it can be a lovely thing. I mean, it really was like having a hobby, except that at the end of it, we got this lovely book that we got to put on the shelf.
Yeah, people, I'm not sure you can put it on the shelf. It's pretty heavy looking.
It does serve as a doorstop as well. And, if you happen to be outside and, you know, things are flapping around, you can use it, you know, to weight things down. But we wanted it to be as definitive as it could possibly be, which is one of the reasons we organized it from A to Z, and wanted it to feel like an encyclopedia, but a really fun one to leaf through.
Your relationship.
I don't think anyone has actually read it, you know, from page one to page 700 and whatever it is, except the two of us. But it's not intended that way. It's supposed to be flipped through and sort of popped into from time to time.
Yeah, read it in your spare time or after a big fight or something like that.
After a big fight is a good time to read it.
Your relationship with your husband started with a blind date, I understand, and a few months later you were making wedding plans. If you had had your book, the wedding book, available to you then, would you have done anything different prior to marriage or during the years of marriage that you've already experienced?
I think, honestly, if we'd had our book then to read, we would have been terrified of all the pitfalls that marriage might present. But if we kept at it, we would also have found a lot of inspiration in there. Really, some of the most wonderful passages in the book are from writers long gone who talked about the beauty and importance of commitment and marriage and love, and all of that would have calmed us down after we'd read the passages of cautionary tales, which are admittedly at times a little off-putting.
You know, in recent years, modern societies have been having this roaring, sometimes angry debate over exactly what marriage means and who it is meant for, and many people cite marriage's use and our approach to marriage over time. Can that debate be informed in any way by your book? Would the facts being used on either side be changed by looking at your book or at the primary research that you used for your book?
Well, I may be thinking a lot right now about the Tony Awards and Lin-Manuel Miranda saying love is love is love is love. But I think that that probably is the takeaway that transcends an awful lot of time and a lot of circumstances, certainly sexual orientation, differences in age and background and all the rest of it. It does seem, historically anyway, as if even going back centuries, there were marriages in which love and the desire to keep the marriage going were the defining factors. Now, having said that, I also have to add that the circumstances around marriage have changed hugely in the centuries that it's been recorded. So it's hard to say that, you know, love conquers all, but there certainly are moments in history in which it's staggering to see just how little emotions have changed, even as circumstances have.
You have so many different sources in this book, people talking about marriage, giving advice on marriage, explaining their own marriage, talking about various aspects of their marriage. And it goes way, way, way back. We're talking about the BC. You have quotes in there. And it's 700 pages or somewhere near 700 pages. How did you research all of this? How long did it take? Where did you find the sources for all this material?
Well, the thing about marriage is that if you look at any random bookshelf, I mean really random bookshelf, you know, cover your eyes and reach out a hand, you will find a book that has something about marriage in it. I mean, it's everywhere. It is such a pervasive subject for fiction and nonfiction. How we researched it, well, we knew that there were, we started knowing that there were some favorite passages that each of us had from our separate and educations and also from having lived together for all these years. And so we said, oh, we've got to get that quote from Pride and Prejudice. Oh, don't forget that poem by Robert Louis Stevenson. And, you know, Mencken had some interesting things to say. That was the easy part, was just kind of rounding up the stuff we already knew. And then beyond that, we started sort of grouping things into large categories, you know, advice for husbands, advice about sex, things that were said about divorce, encouragement that spouses gave one another, things that we thought were sort of essential elements of marriage. And then having figured some of those out, we started looking for entries that would support those. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a back and forth. I can't pretend for a moment that any book on marriage could ever be definitive, because there's just endless additions to the canon. But we were trying to be as broad as we could possibly be in our reach, while limiting ourselves to the English language, because we figured at a certain point we can't cross the Atlantic too often and try to translate some of the amazing things that have been said in other languages. So that was our main limit. We have to be able to understand them.
Marriages have taken place for a lot of different reasons in different cultures and in different times. They have not always necessarily been for love. In fact, I understand, and you may correct me on this, that love is just a recent invention for a reason to get married. But is there a common thread running through all of these various different kinds of marriages for different reasons? Is there any common advice people use to maintain harmony in a marriage if that marriage was not necessarily for love?
You're of course right that love was not the reason. When I said before that I had been inspired by Love is Love is Love, it's just that no matter what the reason or circumstance under which people marry, very often the success or happiness or longevity of a marriage turned out to be due to the fact that people either loved each other very much at the outset or came to love each other through proximity. As far as the common themes, love really, you're right, had much less to do than property, proximity, the need to have children to create a sort of stable social order. all of those things were the reasons that people paired off. And, you know, it's important to remember that, and still sort of surprising every time I remember it, that it wasn't until, you know, the middle of the 18th century that people in this country even started, the 19th century, that women could even own property, keep the money they earned or the property they inherited. So naturally, a lot of the advice that has been given to people in marriages about how to keep it together, and a lot about how to keep a man happy. So the genders and the way that advice has been given to them has certainly changed.
We're going to talk more about that advice and find out some pieces of advice that have been passed down through the ages as we continue our conversation with Lisa Grunwald about the marriage book on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHA. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Lisa Grunwald, who, along with her journalist husband, Stephen Adler, have put together The Marriage Book, Centuries of Advice, Inspiration, and Cautionary Tales from Adam and Eve to Zoloft. It really is an A to Z book here. And on Twitter and Facebook and email, we'd like to hear from you. What's the best or worst marriage advice that you've received? We'll share some of your thoughts, talk about that as we go through the rest of the hour here. You know, despite long periods when marriage, particularly among the wealthy or politically connected, was about solidifying that wealth and those family connections, you found a lot of writing that indicated an eventual romantic attachment to the spouses in those arranged marriages, and one dates back to 1 BC. What was your reaction to that? Was that surprising to you?
Are you talking about the Ovid entry that said you must keep your lover begging and playing at your and threatening at your door, or are you talking about the Householder of Paris, or are you talking about the Roman eulogy for his wife?
I think the Roman eulogy.
There are actually three to choose from, but
I think the Roman eulogy. Yeah.
Yeah, the Roman eulogy was a knockout. It was actually my husband's all-time favorite entry in the book, and sentimental guy that he is, he could rarely look at it without getting a little choked up. The story was that this man, and it was in the first century, had lost his wife. She died before he did, and he wrote a eulogy to her that was actually inscribed in stone at the time. You know, an extraordinarily expensive thing to do, but it's also a really long eulogy, and only about half of it remains. In any case, his expression of love to her and his belief that she had been the source of all his greatness is extraordinarily moving, especially because it's at a time when, you know, a wife was hardly considered to be an equal to her husband. It was also particularly moving because this wife apparently wasn't able to conceive a child, and at one point had offered to have a surrogate bear this man's child, and she offered to step away. And in his eulogy, he said, you know, it wouldn't have mattered what you could or couldn't have done for me. I would have loved you anyway, and how you could ever have thought that I would choose another. So, yeah, it stretches back centuries. And when you see it and you realize how many years have passed, but that emotion is just as real today as it was then, it's kind of moving.
You know, if someone who didn't marry for love comes to love their spouse, as this person did in 1 BC, should that provide hope or incentive for those who did marry for love but for whom the bloom is off the rose?
It's interesting. I think that one of the key ingredients of marriage, of successful marriage, that Stephen and I came across in our research was simply the belief that marriage can work. So that sort of hang in there, understanding, of course, and it's really important to remember that there are marriages that are abusive, either emotionally or physically, that must be escaped at all costs, and that, you know, just staying together no matter what is not always the best idea. But the notion that it should last is so important. And back in 1906, this man named Elbert Hubbard, who was a sort of Renaissance man in America, inventor, writer, and so forth, he had this lovely thing. He said, there are six requisites in every marriage, in every happy marriage. He said, the first one is faith, and the remaining five are confidence. So there's a lot of that in there, that through the rough times, you have to have some sort of magical faith that it's going to work out. And I think that really does help someone who's going through the tough times.
Let's talk about that, because your husband has said one secret to a successful marriage, and you just said this, is that you have to believe in marriage, not just each other and the relationship. If you don't see marriage as something worth nurturing and the right state for you, you're more likely to bail out. And given the divorce rate in America, which is pretty high, but I'm told it's falling, and I think maybe it's falling because fewer people are getting married, younger people are spending long times together without benefit of marriage. Given the divorce rate, is that what is happening to this institution, that we just don't believe in it anymore, that it isn't worth fighting for, that if it doesn't work, no big deal, we'll move on?
Well, we have the freedom to do that because we have economic freedom that centuries of our predecessors didn't have. I mean, I'm talking about women, of course. For so long, if you divorced or separated, or even if your husband left you, as a married woman, you had no recourse at all. You couldn't keep your own wages. You couldn't keep any property you'd inherited. And, you know, your husband could do almost anything to you. And leaving was even worse than staying. Fortunately, women have choice now and the ability to support themselves and to decide whether they're living the lives they want. But for men, too, because we are all living so much longer, there are phases in a life, and if a couple has children together and they raise them together and then they still have another 20 years or so, or 30 if you're lucky, to live and be together, very often they turn to each other and say, well, you know, we've done this thing, we've raised these children, now are you who I really want? Is this the way I want to be happy?
And that is where the divorce rate is highest. It's highest among older people now, who, I guess, as you say, they've done the marriage thing, they've seen through their responsibilities to their children, and now let's just do something else. Where did that come from? I know it's economic freedom, but also there's a lack of stigma attached to it now. There used to be a great stigma attached to divorce. There is no stigma anymore.
It was a huge stigma. It was, you know, you had failed, especially as a woman. Something was terribly wrong, and you were living half a life. I don't think that is the case anymore. I think that marriage feels more and more like a route to happiness, and if it's not making you happy, then you move on. And that rise in expectation that comes along with economic freedom is a double-edged sword. I mean, you, of course, happiness is a lovely thing to want and to expect, but to expect any relationship to give you everything you need in life, I think is safe to say is unrealistic. So if you go into marriage thinking that it's going to solve all your problems, answer all your questions, and provide all your joy, you're bound to be disappointed. I think you have to go into marriage expecting that there will be disappointments and imperfections, and figure out a way to hang in there despite that, and I do think it gets richer as a consequence, and really better than a lot of people I know feel that, you know, it's better and richer after 20 years than after two.
You told Yahoo Style, an interviewer for Yahoo Style, that your best marriage advice is to marry someone you like who makes you laugh. And I've heard that many times before. But can that sustain a long-term married relationship? I mean, what do you do when you've heard all of his or her jokes? How can you make somebody laugh 10 or 20 or 30 years down the road after you've also seen all of their warts?
I think that you, first of all, you need to know that when I say, you know, or when I said marry someone who makes you laugh, it's really about friendship. And I don't, not to take anything away from sex, which is fabulous, sex is great, sex is terrific, married sex is wonderful, but friendship ultimately is what keeps you together. And sometimes that's, you know, making you laugh, and sometimes that's just, you know, saying exactly the same thing at the exact same moment because you've worn yourselves into each other in a way that is just uncanny. I mean, Stephen and I, this happens to Stephen and me all the time. We'll be watching something on the tube and we'll simultaneously say the same thing and then just crack up because, you know, how could we possibly have that same reaction?
Does that come from years together, or does it become from something that brought you together in the first place, this similarity of thought, this shared experience of the world, internal experience of the world?
I think it's both. I think that, well, we were lucky enough to recognize kindred spirits in each other and just say, oh, I get it. This is what I've been looking for. Mm. And it felt so natural, and we were both ready, and it just seemed like we were exhaling, like, oh, yeah, finally, this is what people have been talking about. But the real depth of it, the joy of it, is something that's built up over years and years of shared experiences and inside jokes and, you know, responses to world events, both good and bad, knowing what is going to make him happy and knowing what is going to make him sad. And I don't think you get that in the first couple years. You don't get it without some hard knocks. And I'm not trying to be Pollyanna-ish about the institution. I mean, it has its real downsides. But I do think that if you are married to somebody who you basically like and who basically likes you, you have to remember that and let it help you transcend the moments where you just can't stand the fact that he leaves the cabinet doors in the kitchen open. And I'm using that example because he can't stand the fact that I leave the cabinet doors in the kitchen open. And somehow he's managed to put up with me despite the fact that I leave the cabinet
doors. You've also said, and I don't know whether this comes from the advice you uncovered in the course of putting together this book on marriage or whether this is something you learned in the course of your own relationship, but you've said that you and your husband are the guardians of each other's better selves. Explain that.
This is, if I had anything to take away from either our 28 years of marriage or our 6 years of researching the book and the history that it showed me, this is the number one thing. And I'm going to quote the poet William Butler Yeats, who said this in the most beautiful way. It was in his journal. He wrote, "In wise love, each divines the high secret self of the other, and refusing to believe in the mere daily self, creates a mirror where the lover or the beloved sees an image to copy in daily life."
I read that 3 times yesterday, and I have a really difficult time following that. So break, I mean that. So break that down. The mirror, say that last part again. This is where I get lost.
Creates a mirror where the lover or the beloved sees an image to copy in daily life.
So are they copying your behavior, or are you just showing their behavior back to them?
You are the guardian of who they want to be, and so you're the mirror reflecting them.
So you're reminding them of who they want to be, so that when they get off track, you're putting them back on the track? Is that what he's saying?
Exactly. And this is both – this is what I really believe. I mean, forget – me as an editor, me as a writer, me as a novelist, but just me as a married woman, I feel that my job is to remind my husband without nagging, but just keep, I have to keep inside me what I know that he wants. And I don't mean wants from me. I just mean wants from himself, the person he most strives to be. And
how do you learn that about the other person?
Well, it sounds kind of silly, but I asked. It was before we got married, and I said to him, and you know what you've said before, earlier in our interview, we did get married or got engaged after just a few months together. But in those months, somewhere in there, I said, by the way, what do you want from life? And do you want, how ambitious are you? Do you want fame? Do you want money? Do you want power? What do you want? And his answer to me was, you know, part of the reason that I would pretty much follow him to the ends of the earth. What he actually said was, none of those things as much as I want to be Atticus Finch. He said, I want to be the person in the room who people turn to figure out, you know, what's the right thing to do in this situation or that.
And so you remind him of that on a regular basis to get him back on track. Lisa Grunwald is our guest. She, with her husband, journalist Stephen Adler, have written The Marriage Book. We'll talk about more of their findings as we go through the hour. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Lisa Grunwald is our guest. She and her husband, Stephen Adler, wrote The Marriage Book, Centuries of Advice, Inspiration, and Cautionary Tales from Adam and Eve to Zoloft. We asked you what you thought about marriage and the best marriage advice or the worst marriage advice you've ever received. Ricky on Twitter writes, come to understand that all the things you hate about your spouse may never change. Be ready to love them anyway. That could be in your book. That could be, probably is in your book.
Absolutely. Second edition. I see it now. I think that is absolutely true. In our book, we quote some songs as well as poems and passages from fiction and nonfiction. And right in there is the great lyrics from Guys and Dolls, Marry the Man Today and Change His Ways Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a good plan for a marriage. You can't expect that the person you marry is going to be miraculously different from the person you marry. I mean, you obviously will grow toward each other or apart from each other, depending on how you approach things. But
and then there's Oscar Hammerstein's lyric from the Carousel. What's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? He's your fella and you love him, and that's all there is to that.
Yeah, the only problem with the Carousel quote that I've always had an issue with is it's written by a woman. I mean, it's sung by a woman who gets beaten.
Beaten, yes. There's a problem with that.
And basically says,
That's why that show isn't revived very often.
Exactly. I mean, the music is beautiful. Yeah. And certainly those words I apply. What's the difference? But when you know the backstory on the musical, it sort of puts a little bit of a shadow over the thing.
There's some very funny quotes in your book. Among them, the caution from a British author in 1936 that husbands shouldn't think that their wives have placed waste paper baskets in the rooms as ornaments. And we still have that stereotypical sloppy husband, neat wife thing going on, the woman desperately trying to make a home while he continues to live as though he were in a dorm room somewhere. What does that tell us about the nature of trying to make a long-lasting commitment between two alien species?
Well, firstly, I think that the image of the sloppy husband is really, ads on television and so forth seem to support this all the time. The husband isn't just sloppy, but he's childlike. You know, he leaves his clothes around, or he doesn't know how to do the wash, or, you know, wives are constantly corralling husbands and educating them about things that, you know, their children might have known when they were five. So I think that image is one that is worth fighting, not only in the culture, but also in your own home.
Okay.
There is, however, a huge amount of advice over the years that's been given along those lines. You know, how do you keep your husband happy? How do you keep your wife happy? How do you get them? How do you sort of train them? One of my favorite things in the book is a marital rating scale that was created by a man named George Crane in 1939, and it awards points based on, you know, how well somebody does something or doesn't. And the wife is allowed to rate the husband according to certain things, and the demerits that she gives him are along these lines. Like if he's, I'm looking at the list here, demerit, careless in bathroom, leaves razor out or ring around tub, fails to come home to table promptly when meal is ready, angry if newspaper is disarranged. I mean, that sort of thing. So I think that there's a long tradition of seeing the husband as somebody who needs to be corralled. But on the other hand, George Crane also, you know, lists things that are demerits for wives, and those are, you know, as sort of culturally stereotypical as the other.
Deborah emails, I always tell my young friends who are looking for a life partner to ask themselves this question: am I the best version of myself when I am with this person? Do you understand that?
I think that's wonderful. And I think it's as true as the other question, or as my other, you know, favorite bit of advice, which is to keep track of who your spouse's best self is. But it is absolutely true. And I wouldn't say just the best version of yourself, but are you the most authentic version of yourself? I remember working once with a woman who told me in all seriousness, and this was just, I don't know, 15 years ago, it's not like it was ancient history, she told me that she used to wake up in the morning before her husband so that she would put her makeup on, so that when she woke up, when he woke up, he would see this, you know, made-up, beautiful version of her sleeping in bed beside him. And I remember thinking, I could never live that way. I mean, I could never have that level of pretense. How do you maintain a marriage if you're literally painting your face in the morning to have him see someone you're not, or you're not naturally? So I think you're the person who wrote that email is absolutely right that that's a crucial question to ask. And it's not just, are you the happiest version of yourself? Because you can find, you know, 18-year-olds dating who make each other incredibly happy. But it's really, are you the most authentic version of yourself?
Marriage isn't just about being nice or respectful of each other or even supportive of each other, although it's about all of those things. It's also about being able to keep the spark alive year after year, despite Nora Ephron's observation that you have in your book that the man is capable of having sex with a Venetian blind.
Well, God. It makes me laugh every single time I hear it.
What advice did you turn up for keeping that aspect of married life interesting?
Well, it's really interesting, or we found it interesting at any rate, that there are two different and completely contradictory strains of advice about this. One is stay close, and the other is keep some distance. The notion that you can feel the desire that you felt at the beginning, you know, for 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 years is kind of ridiculous. Obviously, things change over time. There's one school of thought that basically says keep some distance. Fire needs air in order to be flamed, to be fanned, and the other is keep at it. I kind of like a combination of the two by way of advice, because, you know, why not have it both ways if you can? But again, I'm going to my quotes, and the delightful fact that in 1829. The French writer Balzac said, just as ideas go on increasing indefinitely, so it ought to be with pleasures. Every night should have its own menu. marriage should war unceasingly against a monster that is the ruin of everything, the monster custom. And then my favorite line, if a man cannot distinguish the difference between the pleasures of two consecutive nights, he has married too early in life. I think that's kind of an inspiring thought.
A lot of people, more and more young people, are deciding, at least for the time being, not to marry. Living together works for them. Having children together without being married works for them. Even buying homes and combining finances without getting married works for them. Is there any reason for them to get married? I mean, what would your book tell them?
Well, my book would tell them different things at different times in history. Obviously, in old days, they would say you need to get married because of the social stability, the economic stability, and because it's a sin not to have
sex outside of marriage.
Sex. Thank you. Sex. That's the word I was looking for. Sex without being married. Now, I think that our book would probably say that there are certain benefits to the institution itself that are worth whatever is taken away. I think, though, that the notion of waiting a little and knowing yourself makes sense. And a lot of people in their 20s who would normally have been married and have had their first children by now are still looking around and making sure that they're making the right decision. And I don't know whether in the end that means that they're going to be more successful or not, but it is nice to think that a little bit of maturity might go into the decision-making about who to marry.
So you've come up with 8 habits of happily married couples. So before you share them, how did you come up with them? How did they evolve? Did they come out of your research, or is this from your personal experience?
No. This was from our research, and actually, the list was compiled, I think, from the book. I'm trying to.
I can tell you what they are. They're grateful. The 8 habits of married couples. The couples are great.
Right.
They're grateful. They forgive and forget. They're each other's cheerleader. They're realistic. They have complete trust in one another. They have spirited conversations. They accept each other's differences, and they know marriage is a work in progress. Of those, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you, please.
I was just going to say, of those, what do you think is the more important or the most important?
It's number 3, I think, on your list, which is
cheerleader.
Yeah,
be each other's cheerleader.
It's what I was saying before about trying to bring out the best, trying to keep your spouse connected to his or her goals. It's so important not to be infected by contempt, and I think contempt is the number one killer of a marriage. If you allow yourself to think the worst of or expect the worst of the person you're married to, you are very often going to have that view fulfilled. On the other hand, if you expect the best, you very often get the best. This may sound simplistic, but I think it is simple that if you're in your husband or wife's corner, you're much more likely to be content and to make him or her content and have something that lasts.
And that would seem to build trust as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no, as far as cheating and adultery and other things that can completely erode trust, that's sort of a different topic, but if you are if you are making somebody happy and they are making you happy, I think that the closeness that engenders does come does bring trust along with it.
And we'll leave it there because we're completely out of time, but that we haven't even scratched the surface of the flyleaf of this enormous book. It's called it's called The Marriage Book: Centuries of Advice, Inspiration, and Cautionary Tales from Adam and Eve to Zoloft by Lisa Grunwald, our guest this morning, and her husband, Stephen Adler. Thank you very much for the hour. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome. It was fun.